Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hello, and welcome to Rosebud, the podcast about interesting people and their first memories. We've had extraordinary guests from Dame Judi Dench to Sir Michael Palin, actors, entertainers, writers, Oscar winners, an astrophysicist, an Archbishop of Canterbury, all sorts. And this week is no exception. Though this week, I'm not in our usual studio at Grosvenor House in London's Park Lane. I'm on a train travelling from London to Burton-on-Trent, where I'm meeting up with the man who aspires to be the United Kingdom's next Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer. A lawyer by training, an MP since 2015, leader of the opposition since 2020, you've seen him on TV and at the dispatch box. But who is he? Where does he come from? Who were his parents? What were his boyhood hopes and dreams? What made him what he is? I promise you, there'll be no party politics here, but some interesting stories, I hope, some laughs, and even, perhaps, some tears. Cue the music. I want to begin, Keir, if I may, with the same question I always begin with. What is your very first memory?
I've never been asked that before. So, in terms of memory and impression, I think I must have been about 4 years old when we got our first car, a Ford Cortina, a blue Ford Cortina. And I remember the build-up to this, and then waiting by the front door for hours for my dad to come home with this new car. That's a first, if you like, vivid memory that I have of me sort of in shorts and a t-shirt, but a striped t-shirt, and the wonder of this thing called a car.
And where was this happening, and who was your dad?
So this was in our house in Oxted, Hurst Green, on the Surrey-Kent border. And my dad was a toolmaker, worked in a factory all his life. My mum was a nurse until she sadly got too ill. And so we didn't have a lot of money. And so a car was a really big deal to get this Ford Cortina. So I remember that. And I've also got a memory of cleaning it. I was want this amazing thing. I wanted it to look nice at all times.
You were very proud of it.
Very proud of it. And
do you remember your first drive in it?
No. I mean, I remember, I wouldn't say the first drive, but the general setup was, because they had the, if I remember rightly, sort of right across the back, and no seatbelts, I don't think, and four kids we had, all sitting across the back like a sort of row of children being driven around in this Ford Cortina. I mean, as we got older, we each got a dog. So we had a point where we had two adults in the front, four children in the back, and four dogs in the car at the same time, which I can tell you was a bit of a squeeze. So you can imagine this family setting off year after year. We would go every year to the Lake District, to the same row of cottages in Langdale Valley. It was sort of a row of old, were quarry miners' cottages. And we would drive off with a roof rack four children, four dogs, and mum and dad in the front, all the way to Lake District every year.
And what was your dog called?
Percy, a red setter.
And did you name him Percy?
I did. I think I named him Percy after the railway books and Percy the train engine.
Oh. Tell me about your parents. Your dad, Rod, was his name. It's your middle name.
Yes.
What was his character? What sort of personality did he have?
He was a working man, proud. He was a toolmaker. He would have liked to have gone to university. He really would have liked to have gone to university. But he didn't have the money. The family didn't have the money. He didn't get the chance. So he became a toolmaker. He worked at night school to get his qualifications, did an apprenticeship, and worked in a factory all his life. For most of his life, he worked for somebody else. Towards the end, he was self-employed. Very skilled. So my image of him at work is this guy in big steel toe caps, overall on, Swarfiga, you know, cleaning himself every night. Standing on decking, because if you stand in a factory all day, you stand on decking, because you know that a concrete floor is very hard, and decking just gives you a little bit of give, makes you less tired over the course of the day. And he'd work in that factory long, long hours. But he felt disrespected. And I have this memory of my mum and dad having people round to the house, and the inevitable conversation, what do you do for a living? And he would come to his turn. He would say, I work in a factory. And for my dad, there was a gap in the conversation at that point where nobody knew what to say. And that made him feel that he was disrespected, he wasn't valued. And he hated it, and it ate away at him. And, I mean, I've seen this more clearly in retrospect and after the event, I have to say. But it caused him to retreat. So we didn't have people around very often. He would very rarely go out with friends for a meal or whatever. And I think at the heart of that was this sense that he felt, because he worked on the shop floor, he was disrespected by other people, this sense of disrespect. And it's, for me, that's helped me, because respect and dignity are two of the things that I care about hugely. You know, in politics, you've got your big policy issues here, there and everywhere.
Did it make it difficult for him to be a warm father, this sense of holding back, being...
It did.
I mean, was because he warm? Was he affectionate towards you?
No, he withdrew. My mum was very ill, very, very... She had Still's disease. That's like juvenile arthritis, but very aggressive. And she got it when she was 11. And she was told two things. You won't be having children, and you'll be in a wheelchair by the time you're 20, and you won't walk again. My mum was a very determined woman, and she...
What was her name?
Jo. And so Rod and Jo, they were an item, in the sense that there was never Rod without Jo, never Jo without Rod. She had a brilliant consultant up at Guy's Hospital who tried her on this sort of wonder drug, steroid-based drug, and that meant that she didn't go into a wheelchair when she was 20. She had lots of operations, difficult operations, but she carried on walking, and she was not prepared to accept that she wasn't going to have children, so she had four children. But it was a struggle. She was very ill. She was touch and go a number of times in intensive care. And my dad dedicated his whole life to her, everything, complete commitment, undying sort of love, knew every symptom she had, knew exactly what had to be done. When she was at hospital, sometimes for a prolonged period, he wouldn't leave the hospital unless he left with her, bringing her home. And that, so all of his, if you like, his emotional energy all went into that relationship of supporting my mum, but it meant there wasn't any space left for the children. And so we weren't close. It wasn't an emotional relationship. I can't even remember the last time I hugged my dad before he died. And therefore, it was a lonely space, I suppose, as a child in some respects. My mum was very warm and bubbly, very, very warm woman. But my dad, not so much, partly because he was withdrawing, because he felt the sense of disrespect, and partly because everything he had was being emotionally invested into this relationship, supportive relationship of my mum. And I knew that somehow this had to be mended, this relationship with my dad, or I've had to find a way of addressing it. And I don't have many regrets in life, but one of them is I never addressed that whilst he was alive. So my mum died just weeks before I became an MP. And then my dad died 3 years later, quite quickly and unexpectedly, but I knew he was dying, and I didn't take that opportunity of talking to him about our relationship, my relationship with him.
So when you were small, who were your close relationships with? Your brothers and sisters?
My brothers and sisters.
Where were you in that?
So I had an older sister.
Yeah.
Then me, 18 months later. Then my younger brother and sister, who were twins, who were about 18 months after me. So we're quite...
And so you, they were your best friends when you were a little boy?
Yeah, we were a group of kids doing our thing. And that was close. We had a three-bedroom house, mum and dad in one. The girls in the other, and me and my brother in the small room. We did a bad bargain with my sisters and got the small room with a bunk bed, which is where I grew up. And we had a field behind us, and we would go and play in the field behind. Things changed when the 11 plus came along, because I passed and my siblings didn't. So I started down a different track, getting a bus to school in Reigate every day, whereas they were at Oxted at the school.
Before you get to being 11, school. What were the games you played as a little boy? In your bunk bedroom, what were you doing?
Oh, I was out the bunk bedroom as much. If you're in a small room with your brother with bunk beds, you're out the room as much as you can. It just wasn't enough space. Out the room, football, football, football. Mm-hmm. So if I could get outside, I was playing probably three or four times a week. There was a local club, Bolthurst Athletic, in her screen, so I signed up with them as soon as I could. And after them, I played for a team in Edenbridge. But that was, for me, football was a massive release. It was a great thing. And Bolthurst Athletic was the local village boys team. And one day, one of the guys who was running it managed to get this clapped out old van. And we put two benches along the side of the van, inside the back, had no windows, painted it with the Bolthurst Athletic colours. And for us, this was like a VIP coach as we went around the villages playing our games, our away games, sitting, all the boys, including me, sitting in the back, no windows, side on this bench, no seatbelts or anything.
Well, you were a happy little boy, really.
It was fantastic.
What's your first recollection of sadness in your life? Did you have grandparents who died? Was there something that happened that made you sad ever?
Yes. It was when I was about 13. And my mum was in hospital. And I was at home with my siblings. My dad was at the hospital, of course, with my mum up in London. And he phoned. I was in the kitchen. And he said, "I don't think your mum's going to make it." Exact words. First time in my life, I actually thought we're going to lose her. And that is a very raw memory. Mm. She pulled through, and then we went through that a number of other times, but that was the very first time as a 13-year-old.
But it's interesting.
And he didn't forewarn me what he was going to say. He didn't say, "I've got something difficult to tell you." He just said...
But he did tell you. It's interesting that he told you, in the sense that he did reach out to you at that moment. Did he call the others as well?
No, he asked me to tell them, which I can't remember that bit. I can't remember how I did that.
That's one of those moments.
It was just that. I remember holding the receiver and hearing those words.
And so what age were you when you were grown up by the time she did die?
Yes.
So... All so was well. It was a roller coaster.
It was a roller coaster. She would be in intensive care, get better, go back into intensive care for other things, she would always get up and walk. I want to walk, I want to walk, I want to walk. Which, why, I mean, it's amazing to go to the Lake District. What do you do if you can't walk? If you're my mum, you go to the one place where the only thing you can do is walk. Yeah. So she's determined, I am going to walk. And then there came a point, about probably 10 years before she died, where she got so ill she had to have her leg amputated. And this was the end of the walk forever. The one thing that kept her going. And that then, I think, destroyed her spirit. And she was then in a wheelchair. She couldn't get in and out of bed. Gradually lost the ability to control her hands. Didn't speak. And I think that, I genuinely think that not being able to get back up and walk, which had just kept her going, in the end, broke her spirit. And sadly, as I say, she died just before I became an MP, which she would have loved. She'd have loved to have seen that day. And our children were young. And so they never had a conversation with her, because by the time they saw her, she wasn't able really to move, to get out of bed, to communicate with them. And that's a real sadness for me, because they've never seen her as she really was.
When you were young and a teenager, did you share this with your with the twins and your sister? Did you talk about these things?
No. We were quite a... I don't know. There are certain sort of, I don't know, English families that don't know. In a funny kind of way, we just... it was get on with it territory. And so we didn't talk about it. We didn't... There wasn't a sort of habit within our family of talking things through. We just sort of got on with it, even when there were those difficult moments. I mean, we do talk about it a bit now, but we didn't as... You'd have thought we would, you know, what are we going to do?
It's Giles here, and I'm delighted to tell you that 2024 is a very special time for our sponsor, the J.W. Marriott Grosvenor House, because it's their 95th birthday. Yes, in 1929, Grosvenor House opened to the public for the first time. And ever since then, it's been setting the standard for service, comfort, food, and hospitality. In celebration of this momentous anniversary, Grosvenor House and Rosebud are offering listeners the chance to book a special Rosebud tea at the hotel from the 18th of March until the 8th of May. This will be served in the beautiful park room overlooking Hyde Park and will feature a delicious English cream tea with clotted cream, rose petal jam, a pot of Newby fine tea, and a selection of delicate rosebud-themed cakes. Visit www.parkroom.co.uk. That's www.parkroom, all one word, .co.uk to book. In the meantime, please join me in wishing the J.W. Marriott Grosvenor House and everyone who works there a very happy 95th anniversary. May you carry on being the very best at what you do for many years to come. 95. Wow.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
This episode is brought to you by Smart Food Popcorn. Some decisions aren't the best, like skipping ahead in your favorite podcast. Think of all the banter you'll miss, the lore in the making. Luckily, Smart Food Popcorn is a no-brainer. Deliciously tasty and available in a variety of fun flavors. It's a smart decision every time. Smart Food. Add smart. To learn more, visit smartfood.com.
Who's your best friend at school?
One of my best friends at school is still one of my best friends, so I've had very, very long friendships. A guy called Colin, I've called him John all my life. So he calls me John, I call him John, don't know why.
Well, you probably didn't want to be called Keir by him. I mean, has that been a nightmare, being called Keir?
Well, I now really like being called Keir.
But it's quite useful now.
Yeah, it is quite useful now.
It puts you in, you've got a bit of a heritage
but
there.
But when I was growing up, I was one of these kids that I didn't want to stand out. I didn't want to be the centre of attention. And being called Keir made me stand out. And Keir rhymes with a lot of things that kids love saying at school. So I just wanted to be called Pete or Dave or, yeah. or John.
But not Rodney.
Not Rodney, no. I've never liked that name.
Indeed. Okay, so when you're this age, I knew what I wanted to be by the time I was 11. When did you
really?
Oh, yes. But it was a multiplicity of things.
But you had that clarity of...
I had that clarity, yes. I was 11, 1959, and I stood in the school mock election.
Right. And so you really did know where you were.
Certainly. I was the candidate, as I was in 64, 66. Oh, absolutely. I was there right from the beginning. It was only when the public decided otherwise that I had to think of other things to do. Now, I was clear. I had a variety of ambitions. I wanted to write. I wanted to be Prime Minister. I wanted to be an entertainer. But I could picture it all. What were your daydreams when you got in to the grammar school, having passed the 11 plus, which was exceptional in your family?
Yeah.
You were clearly a clever boy. Love the football, but what did you hope? What were your in your head? What was going on?
In terms of what I would do, not a lot. I wanted to play football, and in the end, I wasn't good enough. But I didn't know what I wanted to do. I think there were two reasons for that, which actually I carry with me because I think they're very important. The first is I hadn't been exposed to a lot of things. My dad had retreated with him and mum, so we didn't have other people around to the house who did other jobs, so I wasn't exposed to it there. The only work environment I'd ever known before I left to go to university was my dad's factory. I'd never been in an office. I went to Leeds University to study law. I'd never met a lawyer. I had very little idea what lawyers did. In the end, I did law because I think I'd got very interested in politics. I think my parents had thought there's a danger side. We need to get him off that idea. And he needs a secure job. Law is a secure job. And so, you know, they helped me decide that I was going to do law. That was the first thing. The second thing was opposite to your experience, where I'm really fascinated. I didn't think, insofar as I thought about politics and an MP, I didn't feel that was for me. That wasn't for somebody like me. That's something that happens in your head. So the two things I take into schools now when I go for visits. Firstly, don't let that voice in your head that tells you that this isn't for you. Don't listen to that voice. And the second thing is make sure you're exposed. Have lots of, I say to businesses, get in your school. Nobody can aspire to do something they don't know anything about. Kids will have brilliant aspirations and ambitions, but they need the seed, the idea, to be planted with them.
Did you have childhood heroes, though? Were there people that you admired?
Yeah, they're all footballers.
All footballers?
Yeah, yeah. Pretty much.
Did you go to church? Was faith part of your childhood?
Well, I was christened into the Church of England.
Were you confirmed?
No. So I was christened, must have been about two, I think.
Yeah.
My mum went, there was St John's Church up the road, and my mum went to that every Sunday. We went to Sunday school for a while, but we didn't go into the main service. But my mum was pretty religious, and so as long as she could walk or get about, she would go up to church every Sunday.
Is faith now part of your life at all?
Yes and no, and I know that's a bit of an odd answer. I'm not a believer in the sense of, you know, believing in God. But I do believe in faith. I think faith is really important. I think there's incredible strength in faith, and the way it has the ability to bind people together, to give people a sort of shared sense of something bigger than themselves.
Because your children are being brought up within a faith.
Well, again, slightly yes and no. So my wife's dad, Vic's dad, is Jewish. His family from Poland. So Vic's extended family is Jewish. Vic's mum converted when she got married, but that wasn't universally accepted within their family, and therefore technically my wife is not Jewish, and therefore neither are our children. But because it's such a big part of her family, her extended family, both here and with relatives in Israel, we are bringing the kids up to know about their grandfather's faith and religion, and to know. So we do some of the Friday night prayers, for example, and meals.
So your
Seder night, and
there's a value in all this, isn't there?
There's a value in all of that. Like,
so I'm a cultural Christian because I love the traditions, all of that has got value.
Yeah.
Going back to your childhood, you talked about your first memory of sadness. Can you remember your first moment of joy, ecstasy, excitement in your youth?
Well, yes. I mean, there were many of those. I mean, because I played football, any time we scored or won was a moment of great joy. The moment the deepest sense of happiness, I suppose, was when I left home to go to university. By then, I had had a year off. I'd put together some money and I bought a knackered old car. And I got in that car, packed my bags, and drove with a mate to Leeds University. This was 200 miles. I'd never been to Leeds, never been that far up. I was going to set off and drive up 200 and however many miles from my village in Surrey, on the Surrey-Kent border, to the city of Leeds. And I remember this real sense of happiness and freedom, and that I was driving to another world almost, another chapter of my life. And so it was. And so there was this incredible, happiness that I was moving on. I was getting away from this village into a much bigger... Because my dad was had retreated in, it was quite a small world in many respects that I was living in. Fields out the back, family, dogs. And then go to this city of Leeds. And that was amazing. I'd never been to a city, but I hadn't lived in a city.
And did you have a wild time? Did you have a wild...
Yeah, I had a really good time. It was just, everything was going on. But there were nightclubs, there was curried chips. I'd never had that before. There was a cultural explosion in Leeds, lots of different cultures and exposure.
And you live in a flat? Well, how did it work out?
To start with, in a university hall for a year. And then in houses in Leeds with groups of six with mates, which was fantastic. And then down to London to live in grotty flats, paying about eight times the price.
And what did you look like? I mean, were you good looking?
For others to determine.
Were you smooth?
I'll put it. When I left for Leeds, I was leaving the village, as it were, and I had sort of fairly long hair. I don't know whether you remember the footballer Ray Clements, but he had this sort of hair down to his shoulder. So I had my car, my Ray Clements haircut, the sort of Boomtown Rats album under one arm, and a jumper on. Then got to Leeds. I met this guy, John Murray, within a few weeks. He was very cool and trendy, and was had a independent music magazine that he was flogging. So I had my Boomtown Rats. He had this Nag 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 independent magazine he was doing for himself. And then within, I'd say, weeks, suddenly haircut, different clothes. And so by the time I left Leeds University, I'd been through a sort of a special sort of snap course on independent music, and looking better than I did when I arrived.
What were your hobbies there? What were you doing as well as the law course?
Football, a little bit of politics. The miners' strike was on, so that was close, because we were in the middle of Yorkshire, obviously, and that was very intense in terms of the political thinking, and enjoying life. I mean, this was freedom. This was cooking our own meals. This was deciding what we do. I was also, and this sounds curious, and I'm trying to sort of instill it in my kids, I was enjoying learning. I didn't particularly take to O-levels or A-levels. And then when I got to Leeds, having not known anything about the law, I loved it. I really enjoyed studying it. And I was enjoying the privilege, although I didn't see it as that at the time, of learning.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Is there anything from your youth that you are ashamed of? You remember the first time you told a lie or did something you now, I know you're not full of regrets, but now you do feel. I can give you several of my examples, but I'm not going to because I want to hear yours.
I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to think. I mean, there are lots of things that I suppose I didn't do in the way that I would have liked. But really, for me, it's not so much lying, it's loyalty. I'm a big believer in loyalty, which is why I've got lifelong friends. And so any time when I felt I wasn't doing the best for my friends would have been a feeling.
No, I think I really meant something that embarrasses you. I think, oh my goodness, oh God, did I do that?
Oh, well, look at some of the outfits I was wearing when I arrived at Leeds and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I'm no one to talk about people's fashion sense. So what do you think, what is your, now you're here, do you want to be liked? Did you want to be liked as a young person? Just thinking of you having this quite isolated life at home. You become gregarious when you're out on the football pitch. You've now broken free, you're at Leeds University. Do you like to be liked?
Yes. I think we all do.
I
think people who say no, I'm not so sure they're being completely honest. Of course we want to be liked, want to be accepted, want to be... you know, we're human beings. We are, you know, we're families, we're groups, we're friends. So, yes, I do.
It's a difficult thing for a politician, though. I mean, the reason I ask is because a successful politician has to be ready not to be liked and to be ready to say no, whereas everybody, one's instinct, I always want to say yes to everything
and
everybody.
And that is obviously a hard part of politics. You have to say no to people and to things. I think being upfront about when you've got to say no actually helps and is quite liberating. And sometimes for both parties to a conversation that ends in a no, there's a relief because there was sort of pretense that the answer might have been yes. So there is that in politics. I think it goes at different levels. I think on the being liked, I have very, very strong friendships, which have been life enduring. And so in that sense, I still want to be liked. I want to be in those deep, deep friendships, the sort of people I can talk to about anything, not particularly political, actually. A lot of people I knock around with are not particularly political. And I have that safe space away from politics, because politics, well, you know this, it can be an isolating, brutal place where lots of people don't only not like you, but they revel in not liking you. In fact, you know, the whole setup in the chamber, it sounds, until you do it, I mean, I'd be really interested in your first experience. Standing at the dispatch box, so you're on your bench, you stand up, you move whatever it is, a yard, yard and a half forward, stand at the dispatch box, suddenly every friendly face is behind you, and all you've got in front of you is a wall of faces of the opposite party who are doing their level best to make sure that whatever you're trying to say doesn't land. And that's the tribal nature of politics.
At least you've got people behind you who do like you. I mean,
well,
Winston Churchill wasn't it who said, you know, the opposition,
yeah,
the members of Parliament
sitting
on the benches facing you, the enemy are the members of Parliament sitting on the benches behind you.
Yeah, at the moment we're doing all right, but it's always going to be
And of course, one. I think what people outside the Commons don't realise is that much of what you're doing on those Wednesdays is actually rallying your own troops. It's not necessarily for consumption beyond. It is for consumption beyond, but it also performs a role within.
I think that's really important because people think, well, where, you know, have you pinned this answer or pinned that answer? It's much more of a sort of rollercoaster of emotion. Who's up, who's down, whose side is pleased with the way that their leader has gone into or come out of PMQs. Yeah. In that sense, it's much more sort of primary colours.
Okay, we're running out of time. I think It's fascinating talking to you. Just I want to finish with, can you remember the moment you first set eyes on your wife?
Yes. We were doing a case together.
Oh, she's a lawyer.
As I was a lawyer, she was a lawyer. And the first time I set eyes on her was after I'd spoken to her on the phone on a previous occasion. So I was at court because I was about to argue this case. And Vic, my now wife, was the lawyer who had prepared all the files and done all the real work in the case. She was back in the office. And I was about to go and stand in front of the judge and make these various arguments. So I said to those that were with me at court, are these schedules accurate? Because this case is going to stand and fall on the detail in this material I've got in front of me, these documents. They said, yes, it is completely accurate. I said, well, you say that, but who put this together? They said, well, Victoria Alexandra. I said, well, let's get her on the phone then so I can talk to her. So I get her on the phone. So these files, you know, did you put them together? Were they accurate? You know, can I absolutely rely on this? Yes, yes. Then she puts down the phone, and looks around to her colleagues in the room and said, who the F does he think he is? And so that was the start of this beautiful relationship, my beautiful wife. And then I met her. She's a fantastically gorgeous and brilliant woman. And rather tentatively, we patched up and eventually got married. But it wasn't the best of starts. But that's very Vic, which is very streetwise. And I'm not going to be beguiled by these barristers. Who the F does he think he is, as we etched on her heart about me.
Well, thank you for giving us a flavour of your childhood. What finally, do you think you've learnt from it? What do you think? What's your view of the world now from your childhood?
From my childhood, firstly, I want my relationship with my children to be very different to my relationship with my dad. So I've really worked hard at that. So spend a lot of time with them, make time for them, because in politics, you all know this, it's very easy to use up your time. Any politician can fill their diary and think that that means they're doing good work. Sometimes making space. So I always get on a Friday, we sometimes do prayers and Friday night meal, but I'm always home at Friday with the family. If Vic's dad comes round, then we got the family there, making time for the children. But also Vic and I, when our boy was born, our first boy, we sort of agreed with each other, happy and confident. So for our boy, who's now 15 going on 16, doing his GCSEs, and our little girl who's 13, the only thing that we are wanting for them is that they're happy and they're confident. And that is really important to us.
If, by any chance, you lose your seat at the general election, what would you do with your life if you were totally free now?
Oh, I've already got that planned. There's a little bookshop on Kentish Town High Street. And I've always fancied working there. So if all goes badly, you can come and see me in my bookshop and bring your book, and I'll make you a cup of coffee, and we can have a longer discussion.
You know, a book signing session. And I can tell you some.
It'll be your book, not mine, though.
And I'll tell you, well, I'll tell you some of my stories. Keir Starmer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A memorable conversation. I hope you enjoyed it too. Thank you so much for listening to Rosebud this week. We love knowing you're there and we love hearing from you. So do keep in touch, keep listening, and keep recommending us, please, to friends and family. Before I go, it's time for some of your first memories. These are so fascinating and so evocative, so thank you to everyone who's sent something in. We've heard from Angela Hurlstone, who says, my first memory is still with me. I can clearly picture being in my pink painted cot on Christmas morning and being given a big, cuddly, grey stuffed toy dog called Cuddles. He stayed with me for many years. I was born in central London and spent my early childhood there. Escaping to the British Museum on a wet Sunday afternoon to look at the mummies was always a treat. I particularly enjoyed looking at the mummified cat and wondering if it had been owned by a little girl like me. We love hearing from you. Thanks for that, Angela, and finding out about your first memories. So if you want to get in touch, drop us a line at hello@rosebudpodcast.com. And we may well read out your email in the podcast in a few weeks' time. Exciting. Jane, artwork by Freya Betts, and music by Phil Leppard.